in the face and in the groove, tech tales and funding blaze. Welcome to Startup Jazz. Startup Jazz.
And a one and a two. Welcome back, cats and kittens, to another session of Startup Jazz. I'm George, and as always, I am thrilled to be here, tapping my foot to the ever-changing rhythm of the startup world.
And I'm Michelle. It's great to be back with you all for episode 5. George, you seem to have a little extra swing in your step today. Good weekend in the markets?
The market's got its own tempo, Michelle. You know that. Sometimes it's a frantic bebop. Other times it's a slow, cool blues. But no, my energy today comes from the set list we put together. We're covering some fascinating players who are trying to compose the future, and that always gets my blood pumping. It's that feeling of anticipation right before the band hits the first note. You just know it's gonna be good.
I love that. And it's a perfect way to describe the feeling in the startup ecosystem right now. There's so much happening. So many new melodies being written in code and on pitch decks. It's hard to keep up, but that's why we're here, to break it all down solo by solo.
Exactly. We listen to the whole arrangement, from the quietest cymbal brush to the loudest trumpet blast, so our listeners can hear the full composition. We're not just here for the hit singles, we're here for the deep cuts, the B-sides, the story behind the music.
And speaking of the story, we have a great narrative arc for today's show. We're going to start with a concept, an idea, that's more like a musical theory than a specific instrument. And then we'll move on to a company that's putting that theory into practice in a very loud, very impactful way.
I like that. We're starting with the sheet music, then listening to the performance.
Precisely. So, for our opening segment today, we're going to kick things off by riffing on the fantastic article from Entrepreneur magazine. It tries to answer a question I think every founder and investor has asked. What's the one trait that truly separates successful fintech founders from everyone else?
Ooh, that's a big one. It's like asking what makes John Coltrane Coltrane. Is it the technique, the innovation, the soul? I'm leaning in.
Well, the article argues it's one thing, foresight, but not in a crystal ball fortune-telling kind of way. It's about building a system of foresight.
A system of foresight. Okay, now you're talking my language. That's not just improvisation. That's composition. That's knowing your scale so well you can play the notes that haven't even been written yet.
Exactly. And after we unpack what that really means for fintech, we're going to turn our attention to a problem that is, well, it's enormous and getting bigger by the second. AI is taking over the world, but it's threatening to break our power grid in the process.
The machine is hungry.
The machine is starving. And we'll be looking at a startup from the M13 portfolio called Daylight Energy. They have a radical, decentralized idea for how to feed it, and it involves turning every home into the solution. It's a bold play, and we're going to analyze if their tune is catchy enough to get the whole world humming along.
Fantastic. So a deep dive on founder philosophy, followed by a high-voltage look at the future of energy. Let's drop the needle.
Let's do it. Okay, George, let's start with this entrepreneur piece, the one trait that separates successful fintech founders from the rest. The author, who's a VC and former operator, makes a compelling case for foresight, and he frames it around this concept of the silent period.
The silent period. I know that space well. It's the time between numbers, when the audience is quiet, waiting for you to start the next tune. A lot can happen in that silence.
That's a great way to put it. In the fintech context, the silent period is those months, or even years, where a company is building behind the scenes. They're grinding away on compliance, securing licenses, building infrastructure. Maybe with no product in the market, no revenue, no buzz. It's just quiet, persistent, often thankless work.
It's the woodshedding. It's the hours and hours a musician like Sonny Rollins would spend alone on the Williams Bridge just playing his horn to the sky. No audience, no applause, just honing his craft, developing his sound, preparing for the moment he'd step back on stage. That silent work is what makes the performance seem effortless.
That is the perfect analogy, because the article's point is that this silent period is when the foundation for explosive growth is laid. The author says, then, almost overnight, everything accelerates. Opportunities open up and growth surges. The leaders who thrive in those moments are the ones who had the foresight to anticipate what was coming.
They didn't just get lucky. They were ready for the gig. The phone rang and they already knew the charts.
100%. And this is where the idea of a system of foresight gets really interesting. It's broken down into a few key principles. The first one is to design for elastic scale, not max scale. The conventional wisdom is to grow as you go, to scale your operations gradually. But this author argues that in FinSec, disruptive opportunities don't wait for you to catch up.
So you can't just add another trumpet player when the room gets bigger. You need the whole horn section waiting in the wings, ready to go.
Exactly. The example given is a fintech with 10,000 customers. It's running perfectly. The cautious planner keeps things lean. But what happens if a new government policy or a big partnership suddenly unlocks a market of 10 million users? The cautious player gets completely overwhelmed. Their systems crash, customer service implodes, and the opportunity is lost. But the dark horse, the one who built for 3 to 5x their current needs, they seize that moment and become the market leader overnight.
I love that. It's a different way of thinking about runway and burn rate, isn't it? It frames that extra capacity not as a cost, but as an investment in opportunity. It's like Duke Ellington, who didn't just write music for the saxophone, he wrote for Johnny Hodges on a saxophone. He knew the specific capabilities and sounds of his players and arranged his compositions to anticipate the brilliant solos they could deliver. He was building the system, the band, for a sound that was bigger than the notes on the page. That's building for elastic scale.
And it requires a ton of discipline because you're spending money on something you don't technically need yet. The second principle ties right into this. Treat licenses as real options. The author says he's rarely seen a truly successful fintech that stays in only one country. The nature of the business is global. But getting licensed in a new region is a brutal, time-consuming process.
It's a killer. It can take years and millions of dollars.
And the article's point is that if you wait until you need the license to start applying for it, you are already way too late. The leaders with foresight start the process for, say, a European or an Asian license long before they have a concrete expansion plan. It's a huge resource drain, with no immediate ROI. You have a team working for months with no quantitative metrics to show for it, just faith in the process.
That takes a special kind of leadership, to keep a team motivated when there's no applause. It's like a jazz musician deciding to learn a whole new harmonic system, like the Lydian chromatic concept. It's incredibly difficult, and they might not use it in their next gig or even for the next year. But mastering it gives them a real option. It puts a new tool in their improvisational toolkit. When they're on stage and a moment calls for a sound that no one has ever heard before, they can pull it out. That license is a new set of chords they can play when the opportunity arises.
What a fantastic way to think about it. It's an asset, just a highly illiquid and uncertain one. But if that market opens up, having that license is the difference between sitting on the sidelines and owning the entire space.
And the competitors are still trying to figure out the core changes.
Right. The third pillar of this foresight system is about people. Empower your team with a clear vision. This feels a bit more familiar, but it's critical in the context of scaling. As a company grows, the founder can't be the one making every decision. They become the bottleneck.
The band leader can't tell every musician what note to play in the middle of a solo. It just doesn't work.
No. So the vision has to be so clear, so deeply embedded in the culture, that every single team member can make decisions with confidence because they understand the company's why. The author mentions his own startup, Blaze, where he embedded decision-making templates from day one. These are the things we do. These are the things we don't. This is how we measure value.
That's the chart. That's the head of the tune in jazz. The whole band knows the melody, they know the chord structure, they know the form, AABA. That shared framework is non-negotiable. but because everyone knows it so intimately, it gives them the freedom to improvise within it. The bassist can walk a different line, the drummer can play with the rhythm, the pianist can reharmonize the chords. They can all act independently, yet they're all still playing the same song. That's what a strong vision does. It's freedom through structure.
I've never heard it put that way, but it's perfect. It allows the company to operate at the speed of the entire team, not just the speed of the founder. When that surge of 10 million users comes, the team doesn't have to wait for instructions. The product manager, the engineer, the marketing lead, they all know the melody and can improvise their part to meet the moment.
They just play. It's beautiful.
And the final point is to embrace the long game. This is about building resilient systems from day one, investing in top-tier infrastructure, security, and compliance even when you're a tiny company and it feels like overkill. The temptation is to cut corners, to use duct tape and glue, and worry about it later. But in fintech, trust is your most valuable asset, and later arrives a lot faster than you think.
The irony of the overnight success is that the work was done over 1,000 nights before.
That's a direct quote from the article, almost word for word. The real work has already been done quietly over many months of persistence. It's a powerful reminder that in this specific sector, patience and preparation often beat pure speed. It's not for the faint of heart. It requires, as the author says, a tolerance for delayed gratification.
Well, that's the blues, isn't it? It's the long, slow bend of a note that holds all the tension and emotion. It's not the flashy, fast stuff. It's the patience to let the music breathe. It seems the best fintech founders have a lot of soul, a lot of blues in them. They understand the power of the quiet moments.
I think that's a great takeaway. Foresight isn't magic. It's a disciplined, systematic approach to preparing for a future you can't see yet. It's about having the courage to spend time and money on things that won't pay off for years, but will be the only things that matter when your moment finally arrives.
So the advice is, spend more time in the woodshed, build your chops, learn your theory, and design the band for the stadium, even when you're still playing in a smoky club.
That's it. And that philosophy of preparing for a massive surge in demand is the perfect transition to our next topic. Because right now, the entire tech industry is creating a surge that is bigger than anything we've ever seen.
You're talking about the insatiable appetite of AI.
Exactly. I was floored by this article in Crunchbase News by Mark Grace from M13. The title says it all. The grid can't keep up with AI, but startups are primed to help. George, the stats in this piece are staggering. For the first time in 20 years, electricity demand in the U.S. is going up, not down.
20 years? For two decades, we've been getting more and more efficient, and now that whole trend has reversed course?
Completely reversed, and it's almost entirely because of the massive data centers needed to train and run AI models. Demand is expected to increase more than 30% over the next decade, and our grid is old, strained, and not ready. The article points out that Americans are already experiencing 61% more outage time than they did a decade ago. We're paying more for a less reliable service, and that's before the real AI demand hits.
So we've got a problem, a big system-wide problem. The rhythm section is about to fall apart.
That's putting it mildly. And the traditional solution, getting our centralized utilities to build more massive power plants, is just too slow. The article highlights this incredible statistic. In 2025, the U.S. is projected to add about 63 gigawatts of utility-scale capacity. In 2024, China added 429 gigawatts.
Seven times more. That's not even in the same league. We're playing in a coffee shop, and they're building Radio City Music Hall every other month.
It's a wake-up call. The top-down, centralized model can't keep up. So, the article argues, the solution has to come from the bottom up, from the edge. And that's where startups come in, specifically a company called Daylight Energy.
Daylight Energy. Okay, so what's their song?
Their approach is fascinating. They're tackling the problem of distributed energy resources, or DERs. Think rooftop solar panels, home battery storage systems like a Tesla Powerwall, even your electric vehicle. Individually, they're small. But what if you could coordinate thousands or millions of them? You'd have a massive, decentralized power plant, a virtual power plant.
I see. So instead of one giant power station, you have a million little ones all playing in concert. The old utility model is like a rigid, classical orchestra, playing a score exactly as written. It's powerful, but it's monolithic and slow to change. This new model sounds more like a jazz combo. It's nimble, it's responsive, and every player has a crucial role.
That's the idea. But the challenge is coordination. How do you get millions of homeowners to participate? Adoption of solar and batteries is growing, but it's still hampered by high costs, especially soft costs like sales and marketing and complex financing. This is where Daylight's key innovation comes in. They use a crypto-based network to create incentives.
Ah, the crypto angle. Always a spicy chord to throw into the mix. How does it work?
The way I understand it, the Daylight Network essentially rewards homeowners and installers with their token for connecting their solar and battery systems to the network. This creates a direct financial incentive that helps offset those high upfront costs that have been a barrier for so long. In exchange for these rewards, homeowners allow their battery to be used as part of this virtual power plant. So, when the grid is strained, say on a hot summer afternoon, the network can draw a small amount of power from thousands of homes simultaneously to stabilize the grid.
So it's a call and response. The grid calls for help, and the network of homes responds with power. That's a very cool kind of improvisation. And they're using the token to solve the customer acquisition problem, which is brilliant if it works.
It's a big if, but it's a bold solution. They recently raised a $15.5 million seed round led by M13 and Founders Fund, so some very smart people believe they're onto something. They're trying to build a bottom-up, organic movement to scale energy generation because we simply can't wait for the government or the utilities to solve this problem on the timeline that AI demands.
So let's talk about the arrangement here. What are the biggest opportunities and the biggest risks? The upside seems obvious. If they can crack this coordination problem, the market is effectively the entire energy market. It's trillions of dollars.
The opportunity is monumental. They are directly addressing one of the biggest bottlenecks to the single most important technology trend of our generation, AI. If AI is the new gold rush, Daylight Energy is selling the picks and shovels, or in this case, the power to run the machinery. By turning passive energy consumers into active, incentivized participants, they change the entire dynamic of the grid.
But the risks have to be just as massive. I see a few just off the top of my head. First, the crypto element. For a mainstream audience of homeowners, that word can still be scary. It can sound complex and risky. They'll have a huge education challenge to overcome that.
That's a major hurdle. They have to make the user experience incredibly simple, where the crypto aspect is almost invisible. It just has to feel like you're getting a discount or a rebate for participating.
Second, the reliance on the incentive model. Will the token be valuable enough and stable enough to truly drive adoption at the scale they need? We've seen a lot of Web3 projects with token incentives that fizzle out. This isn't a game or a social club. This is critical infrastructure. The economics have to be rock solid.
Agreed. And the third risk, which you touched on, is the competition. It's not another startup. It's the incumbent utility industry. These are regulated monopolies with immense political power and a vested interest in maintaining the centralized model. They are not going to sit by and let a startup orchestrate their grid for them without a fight. The regulatory battles could be epic.
It's a David versus Goliath story, but Goliath has a century-long head start and owns all the concert halls. So what Daylight Energy is trying to do here, it's not just building a product, it's trying to conduct a revolution.
And it's a coordination challenge of the highest order. It's one thing to build the tech, but another to orchestrate a two-sided marketplace of homeowners and energy off-takers, all while navigating a patchwork of state and federal regulations.
You know, what they're attempting? It's like trying to lead the world's biggest jam session.
You have thousands, potentially millions of individual players, the homeowners with their batteries. They all have their own rhythm, their own gear. Daylight's job is to be the band leader, to give them a key and a tempo, and bring them all together to create one cohesive, powerful piece of music that can support the main act, which is AI. It's a monumental act of coordination. But if they can pull it off, if they can get everyone in sync, my God, the sound will be absolutely incredible.
That's the dream. A cleaner, more resilient, decentralized grid built from the bottom up. It's one of the most ambitious startup visions I've heard in a long time. The stakes couldn't be higher.
And the timing is perfect. The problem is here, it's real, and it's about to get much, much bigger. They've got their instruments tuned, and the audience is waiting.
Well, we'll be watching very closely to see if they can hit the right notes. All right, that's a deep dive into Foresight and the future of energy. We're going to take a quick break and let the rhythm section take a solo. When we get back, we're shifting gears to look at the new playbook every startup needs to survive in the post-ChatGPT world.
Stick around, folks. The next set is going to be a good one.
And we're back. Before the break, we were talking about Daylight Energy and their plan to build a decentralized power grid to feed the massive energy demands of AI. But that's just one side of the coin. AI isn't just creating infrastructure problems. It's completely rewriting the rules for how startups are built and funded.
That's exactly right, Michelle. It's like the whole band just got handed new instruments and a new time signature. You can't play a bebop solo on a tuba expecting it to sound like Charlie Parker. The entire approach has to change from the ground up.
And that's the perfect lead-in to this piece from Crunchbase News by Matt Blumberg, the CEO of Markup AI. The title says it all. Inside the Post-ChatGPT Playbook, a founder's lessons on building AI-native startups.
A crucial distinction right there in the title. AI-native. Not AI-enabled, not AI-enhanced, but native.
Exactly. And Blumberg argues that this is the tipping point. The first half of 2025 saw billions, with a B, pour into the AI startup ecosystem in the U.S. alone. But he says we're now in a post-ChatGPT era. Generative AI is no longer the magic trick that gets you funding. It's table stakes. It's the cost of entry.
It's no longer a differentiator. It's the new rhythm section. Every band needs a bass and drums to hold down the groove, and every tech startup now needs a generative AI component just to be in the game. But having a rhythm section doesn't make you Thelonious Monk. It just means you're a band. The real question is, what are you going to play over that rhythm? What's the melody?
That's the perfect analogy. Blumberg says if you're still just tacking AI onto your product as an afterthought, you've already fallen behind. He calls it bolting on AI, and he argues it's a losing strategy. As a repeat founder, he talks about relaunching a legacy brand as AI first and learning this lesson the hard way.
This is a fundamental mindset he's talking about. The difference between AI-enabled and AI-native is like this. In the 70s, you had established rock bands who heard synthesizers were cool, so they'd buy a Moog and stick a little synth solo in the middle of a guitar-driven song. That's AI-enabled. It's an addition. It's a feature.
Right. It's a bolt-on.
Exactly. But then you had artists like Kraftwerk or Herbie Hancock during his Headhunters phase. They didn't add synthesizers to their music. The synthesizers were the music. The entire composition, the structure, the sound, it was born from the new technology. It was built around the capabilities and the unique texture of those electronic instruments. That's AI native. The architecture, the go-to-market, the value proposition, it's all conceived through the lens of AI from day one.
I love that comparison, and it really clarifies the challenge Blumberg poses to existing startups. He says they need to ask themselves a really tough question. If we were starting this company today, how would AI define our business? That's a terrifying question for a founder who's 5 years in with an established product and a team of 100 people.
Terrifying, but essential.
It's like a successful big band leader in the 1940s suddenly realizing the future is small, improvisational jazz combos. You can't just tell three-fourths of your orchestra to go home and expect a swing. You have to fundamentally rethink your arrangements, your soloing structure, your entire commercial model. It requires reinvention.
And Blumberg outlines some very clear competitive advantages for the companies that get this right, the ones that embrace that AI at the core mindset. First, he talks about scaling. He says an AI-native approach lets teams scale at startup speeds without burning out. This is huge. We talk about burnout on this show all the time. He argues that by building with automation at the core, teams can experiment, deploy, and iterate faster with fewer roadblocks.
That makes intuitive sense. If your processes are manual and human-driven, scaling means adding more humans, which adds complexity, communication overhead, and cost. If your core processes are automated and managed by AI systems from the get-go, scaling becomes a matter of computing resources, not headcount. The machine doesn't get tired. It doesn't need a vacation.
The second point is personalization. This is a big one. Customer expectations are through the roof. Everyone wants a bespoke, tailored experience. AI is obviously the only way to deliver that at scale. An AI-native company isn't just using AI to recommend a product. It's using AI to alter the user interface in real time, to generate custom onboarding flows, to provide dynamic, context-aware support. The product itself becomes fluid.
And his third point, agility, ties it all together. He says AI-native companies can pivot with market changes and evolving customer needs with less friction. Their infrastructure is already adaptable by design. When a new model like GPT-5 or whatever comes next is released, they aren't trying to figure out how to shoehorn it into a rigid legacy system. Their system is built to be modular, to swap out components, to learn and adapt. It's an improvisational architecture.
But he adds a really important and I think often overlooked layer to this. He calls it trust as a cornerstone of AI strategy. He's very clear that this isn't just about rebranding or plugging in a few APIs. He says the promise of AI is powerful, but founders can't afford to ignore risks around data quality or misinformation.
Thank you. This is the part of the conversation that so often gets lost in the hype cycle. It's the silent part of the music, the rests between the notes that give the melody its meaning. You can have the most technically brilliant AI model in the world, but if your customers don't trust its output, it's worthless. If your investors are worried about the reputational risk of hallucinations or data leaks, you won't get funded.
He says founders need to be champions of responsibility and accountability by designing governance and guardrails into their startup's core. Not as a feature you add in V2, but as part of the foundation. This is what he's doing with his new company, Markup AI, which seems to be focused on this very problem.
And that's what creates a defensible business. This is where Blumberg's advice gets really tactical for founders listening right now. He lays out four key lessons from his experience. The first one is a direct shot across the bow. Tackle the real challenge. Don't build another LLM wrapper.
I think half of Y Combinator's last batch just felt that one.
Seriously. He's saying the gold rush of just putting a pretty UI on top of OpenAI's API is over. The real defensible businesses are solving the new problems that AI itself creates. He lists them. Governance, security, verification. That's where the value is.
Which leads to his second point. Assume AI adoption. He says you should be building for customers who are already using AI and are now hitting a wall. They're dealing with the consequences, the messiness, the unreliability, the security holes. Your product should be the solution to their AI strategy problems. You're not selling them the magic of AI. You're selling them the tools to manage the magic they've already bought into.
It's a second-order effect business, and that's often where the most enduring companies are built. The people who sold shovels and blue jeans during the gold rush made more money than most of the prospectors.
His third point is turn speed into your superpower. He argues the window to build and adapt is shorter than ever. Long-term static roadmaps are a liability. Your competitive advantage is your OODA loop, your ability to observe, orient, decide, and act faster than everyone else.
The tempo of the entire industry has sped up. It's gone from a slow blues to a frantic bebop tune. If you can't keep up, you're going to get left behind. Your ability to improvise, to react to what the other players are doing in real time, is everything.
And his final point brings it all back home. Prioritize trust. He says, in a world of infinite AI-generated content, trust is the most valuable asset. Focus on tools that ensure accuracy, reliability, and brand integrity. It's a fantastic framework, and it carries a lot of weight coming from him. Matt Blumberg isn't a first-time founder chasing a trend. He's led companies like ReturnPath, which was famous for its culture and made Fortune's Best Companies to Work For list, and Bolster. He has a 30-year track record. He's seen a few market cycles.
He's a seasoned band leader who's seen genres come and go. When a guy like that tells you how to arrange your next tune, you listen. This idea of trust being the most valuable asset, it's like the unspoken understanding in a great jazz quartet. When a saxophonist takes a solo, they are flying without a net. They are creating something out of thin air. The only thing that allows them to do that, to take that risk, is the absolute unshakable trust that the rhythm section, the bass, the drums, the piano, is going to be right there with them. They'll provide the foundation, the support, the safety net. If that trust isn't there, the music falls apart. It becomes cautious, boring, and lifeless.
And in the AI world, if that trust isn't there, the product falls apart. No one will integrate a tool into their critical workflows if they can't trust its output. No CEO will bet their company's reputation on an AI that might spit out misinformation or leak proprietary data.
Exactly. So the winners, as Blumberg says, won't just use AI to be faster or cheaper. They'll use it to build businesses that are safer, more reliable, and ultimately more trustworthy. They'll have both the technical virtuosity and the soul. That's the real post-ChatGPT playbook.
A perfect summary. And as we think about who is shaping this new playbook, it's not just the AI-native startups. The incumbent giants are playing a massive role, but in a way that's very different from previous tech cycles. And that brings us to our second article for this segment, also from Crunchbase News.
Let's do it.
The headline is, "Tech Giants Accumulate Huge Startup Stakes Even as M&A Appetite Wanes." The subheader really frames the discussion. Why acquire a startup when you can get a piece of it instead?
Ah, the new strategy. Don't buy the whole band. Just pay a fortune to have the star soloist sit in on your album.
That's a startlingly accurate way to put it. The article points out that over the past couple of years, the Big Five, and for this article, they're defining that as Nvidia, Apple, Microsoft, Google, and Amazon, they haven't been making a lot of huge, splashy acquisitions of venture-backed companies like we saw in the 2010s. The multi-billion dollar buyouts have slowed, but what they are doing is investing extravagantly.
And the numbers are just, they're operating on a different planet.
They truly are. The prime example, of course, is Microsoft and OpenAI. The article cites OpenAI's updated company structure and its reported $500 billion valuation. Based on that, Microsoft's 27% stake is worth around $135 billion. George, let that number sink in. $135 billion for a stake.
It's surreal. The article points out that this single stake is more than six times larger than the biggest private startup acquisition in history, which was Meta buying WhatsApp for about $22 billion back in 2014. Microsoft hasn't acquired OpenAI, but its investment is worth multiples of the biggest acquisition ever. It breaks your brain a little bit.
It completely reframes our understanding of value and control. And it's not an isolated incident. The article highlights Amazon's commitment to invest $8 billion into Anthropic. With Anthropic's valuations soaring to $183 billion this year, Amazon's stake has obviously appreciated massively. Google also invested in Anthropic at lower valuations. So you have this AI arms race where the tech giants are arming the key players, but not actually buying them.
It's a fascinating shift in strategy. In the past, if a startup like Instagram or WhatsApp became a strategic threat or a must-have asset, the playbook was simple.
acquire, absorb the team, integrate the tech, and control the destiny of the product. This new model is more like a feudal system. The giants are patrons, bestowing massive fortunes on their chosen knights, who then go out and fight the battles for them.
So the big question the article poses is, why? Why do this instead of acquiring them? It's clearly not a money issue. The combined market cap of these five companies is over $18 trillion. They could buy any startup they want, multiple times over.
Right, so it's a strategic choice, and I think there are a few layers to it. The most obvious one has to be antitrust. Regulators in the U.S. and Europe are scrutinizing every single move these companies make. A $100 billion acquisition of an AI leader would be dead on arrival. It would be tied up in court for years. An investment, even a massive one, is a much subtler way to exert influence and secure access to the technology without triggering the same level of regulatory alarm.
That's definitely a huge piece of it. It's a regulatory workaround. But the article suggests there are other strategic advantages too. By keeping these AI companies arm's length, they preserve the very thing that makes them special: their focus, their speed, their culture. We've seen it time and time again. A hot, fast-moving startup gets acquired by a tech behemoth and is slowly crushed by bureaucracy, endless meetings, and conflicting priorities.
The band gets signed to a major label, and suddenly they have an army of executives telling them what kind of music to make, and the magic is gone. By investing, Microsoft and Amazon get the benefits: preferred access to models, cloud compute deals, a seat at the table, without the risk of killing the golden goose. They let OpenAI and Anthropic continue to operate in their own hyper-focused, innovative way.
And it lets them place multiple bets. Google has invested in Anthropic, but their own DeepMind division is also a major player. They can have both. It's not an either-or decision. They are essentially outsourcing a huge chunk of their most cutting-edge R&D, and they're paying to ensure it happens on their cloud platform, which is a brilliant business move in itself. Amazon's investment in Anthropic is directly tied to Anthropic using AWS for its primary cloud provider. Microsoft's investment is tied to Azure.
So they get the R&D benefits, they lock in a massive cloud customer, they gain strategic influence, and they get an enormous financial return on paper, all while sidestepping the biggest regulatory headaches. It's an incredibly savvy, multifaceted strategy. It's less like a composed, structured symphony and more like a jam session. You're not buying a finished piece of music, you're investing in the talent and seeing what they create, with the understanding that you get to play along.
And this isn't just happening at the top with OpenAI and Anthropic. The article uses Crunchbase data to show this is a broad trend. So far in 2025, this group of five companies has made at least 208 disclosed startup investments. The collective value of the rounds they participated in is over $70 billion, and that includes both lead investments and participation in syndicates for companies like xAI, Mistral AI, and many others.
208 investments. So that's roughly an investment every single day, just from these five companies. They are acting like the world's largest, most aggressive venture capital firms.
They basically are. They have their own venture arms. Microsoft has M12, Nvidia has N Ventures, Google has GV. But this is even beyond that. These are massive strategic investments coming from the parent corporations themselves.
So let's connect this back to our first topic. What does this mean for the AI native founder that Matt Blumberg was talking about? On one hand, there's an enormous new source of capital available. But what are the strings attached? What does it mean to have Google or Microsoft as your lead investor in your Series B?
That's the multi-trillion dollar question. The upside is obvious: near infinite resources, access to their platforms and distribution channels, and a stamp of validation that is second to none. If Microsoft invests in your AI governance startup, every Fortune 500 company using Azure is now a potential customer. It's a massive go-to-market accelerator.
But the downside, the risk, is that you lose your independence. Your roadmap might start to look suspiciously aligned with your investor's strategic priorities. You might find it very difficult to partner with your investor's main competitor.
It's like a young jazz prodigy getting a record deal with a huge label. Sure, you get the best recording studios and a massive marketing budget, but the label might also tell you to add a pop singer to your track to make it more commercial or to shorten your solos for radio play. You gain resources, but you cede a degree of creative and strategic control.
And there's an even bigger risk. What happens when your strategic investor, who is also one of the world's biggest tech companies, decides to build a feature that competes directly with your core product? You've given them a front row seat to your entire strategy, your data, your customer list. You're in a very precarious position. The power dynamic is incredibly skewed.
You've essentially been paid to be their external R&D lab. And if your experiment is successful, they can choose to either double down on their investment, acquire you, or simply replicate your success internally with their own army of engineers. It's a high wire act for these startups.
It really is. They're taking on a partner who could just as easily become their biggest competitor. But in the current landscape, with the cost of training and running these massive AI models, they might not have a choice. You need a partner with a hyperscale cloud. It's almost a necessity to play at the highest level.
Which means this new investment paradigm is fundamentally reshaping the startup ecosystem. The old narrative of build a great product, find product market fit, scale, and then either IPO or get acquired by a tech giant is being replaced. The new path might be build a great AI native product and then partner with a tech giant early on for capital and compute and effectively become a satellite in their orbit.
A highly valued, very wealthy satellite, but a satellite nonetheless. The potential for a truly independent, standalone outcome like a Salesforce or an Adobe might be shrinking for this generation of AI native companies. They are being woven into the fabric of the Big Five's ecosystems from a very early stage.
It changes the entire composition. The startup world used to feel like a collection of thousands of small independent jazz combos, all trying to make a name for themselves. A few would become big headliners. Now, it feels like there are five massive record labels or five giant orchestras. And all the most talented young players are being recruited to be featured soloists within those larger structures. It makes for some incredible music in the short term, but you have to wonder what it means for the diversity and independence of the entire scene in the long run.
That's the perfect way to frame it. The innovation is explosive, the valuations are astronomical, but the power is becoming more and more concentrated. It's a paradox that will define the tech landscape for the next decade. These two articles paint a vivid picture of a world that is being rebuilt in real time. Startups need a new AI-native playbook to even compete. And the endgame is no longer a simple acquisition, but a complex, high-stakes partnership with the very giants they may have once sought to disrupt.
The whole industry is in the middle of a massive, unpredictable, and incredibly high-tempo improvisation. And we all have a front row seat.
Absolutely. All right, we've covered a lot of ground, from the AI native playbook to the new investment strategies of the tech titans. We're going to take a short break to let all of that sink in. And when we come back, we're contrasting the high-flying world of tech with the reality on the ground for American consumers, and then looking at a company building the physical infrastructure for our future. Stay with us. And we're back on Startup Jazz. Before the break, George, we were deep in the world of AI native startups and the massive multi-billion dollar investments the tech giants are making. It's a world of almost unimaginable scale and speed. But for our next topic, I want to pull the lens back, way back. Instead of focusing on the innovators, I want to talk about the stage on which so many of them have to perform, the American household's balance sheet. And let me tell you, the latest reports suggest that stage is looking a little shaky.
Ah, the macro view. You're talking about the economic rhythm section that underpins everything. Is the tempo slowing down? Is the beat getting a little frantic?
Frantic is a good word for it. An article from Entrepreneur pulling data from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York just laid out some staggering numbers. as of the third quarter of this year, U.S. household debt hit a new record high of $18.59
trillion. $18.5 trillion? That's not just a number. That's an atmosphere. That's a heavy, slow-drag blues tune playing in the background of the entire economy. You can feel the weight of a note like that. What's driving the composition?
Well, the article is pretty clear. While mortgages are, of course, the biggest piece of that pie, at over $13 trillion, the real drivers of the recent growth, the parts that are accelerating, are two specific types of debt: student loans and credit cards.
The usual suspects.
Exactly. Credit card balances grew by $24 billion in the quarter to hit an all-time high of $1.23 trillion. And student loan debt? That's now at $1.65 trillion. But here's the really concerning metric, George. It's not just the total amount, it's the ability to pay it back. Delinquency rates for student loans have shot up. The report says 9.4% of all student loan balances are now 90 days or more delinquent. That's up from 7.8% just a few quarters ago.
Wow. So nearly 1 in 10 student loan dollars is in serious trouble. That's more than just a few sour notes. That's a whole section of the orchestra playing out of tune. It creates a dissonance that affects the entire piece. The Fed researchers in the article tried to soften it, saying debt balances are growing at a moderate pace, but that delinquency number tells a different story.
It really does. And they specifically pointed out that while the overall household balance sheets are pretty strong, they're seeing emerging signs of weakness among younger borrowers. That's the millennial and Gen Z cohort, the exact demographic that so many direct-to-consumer startups are built to target.
And that's the crux of it. For these consumers, especially the younger ones, life is starting to feel like a very complex syncopated rhythm. You've got the steady beat of your rent or mortgage, but then you have these offbeat high-interest card payments and the jarring return of student loan payments hitting at odd times. It's a rhythm that's hard to dance to, and it leaves you feeling constantly off balance. There's no room for improvisation, no room for extra spending when you're just trying to keep up with the beat.
That is the perfect way to describe it. There's no financial slack. So let's pivot this to the startup world. What does this economic backdrop mean for founders and VCs? My first thought is that it's a massive headwind for any company selling non-essential, nice-to-have products. When your credit card is maxed out and you're worried about making your student loan payment, are you really going to sign up for that new artisanal coffee subscription box or buy the latest gadget?
Probably not. The discretionary spending budget is the first thing to get cut when the melody turns minor. We saw this during the dot-com bust. We saw it in 2008. The startups that survive and even thrive in these moments are the ones that shift from being a vitamin to being a painkiller. They have to solve a real pressing problem.
And the most pressing problem for millions of Americans right now is this debt. So doesn't this environment create a massive opportunity for a certain class of startups? I'm thinking about the entire fintech ecosystem built around financial wellness.
Absolutely. This is where a new generation of fintech startups needs to step onto the bandstand and play a compelling counter melody. The main theme right now is this overwhelming drone of debt. The counter melody is financial control, clarity, and a path out. We're talking about startups focused on debt consolidation, automated savings tools, apps for negotiating bills, and platforms that provide real, accessible financial literacy.
Right. Think about companies like Tally, which tries to consolidate credit card debt into a lower interest loan. Or apps like Rocket Money and Truebill that help you find and cancel unwanted subscriptions. They're literally finding money in your budget. Even tools like Acorns or Stash, which encourage micro-investing and saving, become more critical. They offer a sense of forward momentum when everything else feels stagnant.
They're trying to give the consumer a little bit of room to improvise again, to feel like they have some agency in their own financial song. But here's the challenge, the inherent tension in that business model. The customers who need your debt relief product the most are, by definition, the highest risk customers. They have low credit scores, inconsistent cash flow, and are teetering on the edge of delinquency.
That's the underwriting nightmare. How do you build a sustainable, profitable business serving a customer base that is, for lack of a better term, struggling? You have to be incredibly sophisticated with your risk modeling. Your cost of customer acquisition has to be ruthlessly efficient because the lifetime value of each customer might be volatile.
And you're playing in a space that is heavily regulated. The CFPB, the FTC, they are watching this industry like a hawk, and for good reason. You can't just roll out a debt product without navigating a labyrinth of compliance. It's not like building a photo sharing app. The margin for error is zero.
It's so true. Plus, you're competing with the massive inertia of the big banks. For all their flaws, they have scale, they have brand recognition, and they have deep, deep pockets. A startup might have a slicker app and a better user experience, but can they compete with a balance sheet from Chase or Bank of America?
It's tough. The startup has to offer something fundamentally different. Maybe it's a behavioral approach, using psychology to help users build better habits. Maybe it's a community-based model. Or maybe it's a technology advantage, using AI to find patterns and offer advice that a traditional bank just can't. They have to find a new harmony that the old standards can't replicate.
I think the biggest takeaway from this data for any founder, whether they're in fintech or not, is that you have to be hyper aware of your customers' financial reality. The assumption of endless disposable income that fueled the 2010s is gone. Value proposition is everything. Is your product saving them money? Is it saving them time, which they can use to make more money? Is it reducing their stress in a tangible way? If your answer is vague, you're going to struggle.
You have to be the essential track on the album, not the bonus track. Because when people have to cut their budgets, they're cutting the bonus tracks first. It feels like the entire consumer market is just holding its breath, you know? Everyone is watching the Fed, waiting for the conductor to give the downbeat. Will they cut rates? Will inflation cool? That signal will determine the tempo for the next few years, and every startup, especially those serving the American consumer, is waiting for it.
A very precarious position. And it really makes you appreciate the startups that aren't tied directly to the whims of consumer spending, which, funny enough, leads perfectly into our next company. We're going from household debt to industrial infrastructure. We're talking about a company called InfraVision.
InfraVision, I like the name. Sounds like they're giving us a new way to see the foundations of our world. What's their story?
It's a fantastic one. And talk about a company tackling a massive, unsexy, but monumentally important problem. InfraVision aims to transform how high-voltage power lines are built and maintained, and they're doing it with a sophisticated system of aerial robotics.
Power lines. Okay, you're right. That is about as far from a consumer subscription app as you can get. So they're using drones to string up power lines.
It's more than just drones, and that's their key differentiator. According to a Crunchbase News report, they've developed something called the TX system. The CEO describes it as an integrated combination of drones, intelligent ground equipment, and stringing hardware. It's the whole package.
I love that. So this isn't just a hotshot soloist drone flying around showing off. This is a full big band arrangement. You've got the rhythm section on the ground, the intelligent equipment, and you've got the horn section in the air with the drones, all reading from the same sheet music, all perfectly in sync. That's a much more complex and powerful composition.
That's exactly it. And the market is rewarding that vision. They just raised a $91 million Series B round. That's a huge vote of confidence. The round was led by GIC, which is Singapore's sovereign wealth fund, a massive, patient, global investor. Other participants included Activate Capital, Hitachi Ventures, and a returning investor, Energy Impact Partners. This brings their total funding to just under $115 million since they were founded in 2018.
Hitachi Ventures in that list is interesting, a huge industrial conglomerate. That smells like a strategic partnership, not just a financial investment. They see how InfraVision's technology can plug into the broader industrial world. And having your existing Series A lead, Energy Impact Partners, come back for more in the B round is a beautiful harmony. It tells you the people who know
the company best are doubling down.
For sure. The company was founded in Austin, Texas by CEO Cameron Vanderberg, who has a background as a robotics engineer. And they're solving a problem that is becoming more urgent every single day. The article quotes him saying the world needs to double grid infrastructure by 2040 to meet surging electricity demand.
And you can see why, can't you? You've got the explosion of electric vehicles that all need to be charged. You have the proliferation of massive energy-hungry AI data centers. And you have the fundamental shift to renewable energy sources like wind and solar, which are often built in remote locations and need new heavy-duty transmission lines to get that power to the cities. Our 100-year-old grid is not ready for that kind of performance.
It's completely unprepared. The traditional way of stringing power lines is incredibly slow, dangerous, and expensive. It often involves helicopters, which are costly and risky, or massive ground crews cutting paths through difficult terrain. InfraVision claims their system eliminates many of these hazards and contingencies, allowing projects to be completed faster and more cost-effectively. They've already deployed it on projects in Australia and with PG&E in California for emergency response.
They're taking a classic standard, the process of building a power line, which hasn't changed much in decades, and they are completely reharmonizing it with modern technology. The fundamental melody is the same, get a wire from point A to point B, but they're changing the underlying chords, the entire structure, with robotics and data. The result is something that sounds familiar, but feels entirely new and much more efficient.
And their business model is built for this industry. It's a B2B play, and they're not just selling the hardware. They focus on forming long-term strategic partnerships with their customers, the big utilities, contractors, and developers. They lease the equipment and provide services.
That's smart. That's like being the house band at a legendary jazz club. You're not just playing one-off gigs. You're building a long-term residency. You become deeply integrated into the operations of your partners. The switching costs become enormous. PG&E isn't just going to try out another drone company next month if InfraVision's entire system is embedded in their workflow and safety protocols.
That creates a fantastic, sticky revenue model. And they're using this $91 million to scale up fast. Vanderberg says he expects to have 150 to 200 employees by the end of the year. They're staffing up to meet this wave of demand for grid modernization.
That's an aggressive hiring plan. That's where the execution risk comes in. Growing that fast is a challenge for any company, but especially for one that has a major hardware component. It's one thing to scale a SaaS platform. It's another to scale manufacturing, logistics, training, and maintenance for complex robotic systems being deployed in rugged, remote environments. The CEO has to be a world-class band leader to keep all those new players in time and on key.
Absolutely. And let's talk about other risks. What's the competitive landscape look like? Obviously, the biggest competitor is the status quo. It's the inertia of a multi-trillion dollar global industry. You have these massive, established engineering and construction firms like Bechtel or Fluor. They're not just going to cede this ground. They'll either try to acquire the technology or build it themselves.
True, but that's often a slow, lumbering process for a big incumbent. The startup has the advantage of focus and speed. They live and breathe this one problem. For the big guys, it's just one division among many. The bigger risk, I think, comes from the outside.
What do you mean?
I'm thinking about the non-technical hurdles. Regulation, for one. You're flying heavy-duty drones, sometimes over long distances, in what's considered critical airspace. The FAA in the U.S. and equivalent bodies globally have a lot to say about that. The path to getting blanket approval for these kinds of operations can be long and arduous.
That's a great point. And the sales cycle itself has to be brutal. Selling to a utility is a multi-year process involving endless committees, pilot programs, and safety reviews. It's not a quick sign-up-here process. You have to have a very patient capital base to support a business with a sales cycle that long.
It's the opposite of a fast, upbeat bebop tune. It's a slow, deliberate ballad. You have to play every note perfectly and have the stamina to see it through to the end.
But the payoff, if you can land that contract, is immense. These are multi-million, sometimes billion-dollar long-term infrastructure projects.
So despite the risks, execution, competition, regulation, and sales cycles, I have to say I'm incredibly bullish on a company like InfraVision. The macro tailwinds are just too strong. The need for grid modernization is not a hypothetical. It is a legislated, funded, and urgent global priority. The Inflation Reduction Act here in the U.S. alone is funneling hundreds of billions of dollars into this exact area.
I agree completely. They are a pick-and-shovel play on the biggest trends of our time: electrification, AI, and renewable energy. None of it works without a bigger, smarter, more resilient grid. InfraVision isn't just building a company, they're building the circulatory system for the 21st century economy. And having a robotics engineer as the founder and CEO, that's the right band leader for this gig. He's not just a business guy who licensed some tech. He understands the core engineering, the nuts and bolts of the instruments his band is playing. That's a huge advantage.
It is. They're a prime example of a startup tackling a hard, physical world problem with a sophisticated, software-enabled hardware solution. It's capital-intensive, and it's not for the faint-hearted, but the potential moat they can build is enormous. This is the kind of deep tech that can define an entire industry for decades.
A future classic, a new standard in the making. I'll be watching them closely.
Me too. It's a fascinating space. Okay, so we've covered the shaky ground of consumer debt and the high-flying robotics of InfraVision. When we come back, we're closing out the show with two absolute titans that just raised a combined $1 billion, tackling everything from global finance to your daily commute.
Fantastic. From the power grid to the parking garage. Let's do it.
Spirits drag, and the bank account is broke, and my heart's on the rack, and the bar's on my back.
And we are back for the final set of episode 5 of Startup Jazz. We've had a fantastic show so far, covering a lot of ground, from the discipline of FinTech foresight and the energy demands of AI, to the new AI native playbook, the shaky foundation of consumer debt, and the robotics rebuilding our power grid. But Michelle, we've saved a couple of absolute titans for our closing segment. These aren't just startups hitting a high note. These are full-blown symphonies of capital and scale.
That is the perfect way to put it, George. We're talking about two companies that each raised $500 million in a single go. Different industries, different models, but both playing in the big leagues. First up, we're diving back into the world of crypto with a name that's been in the headlines for years, for all sorts of reasons. Ripple.
Ah, Ripple. A name that for some sounds like a smooth flowing melody, and for others, it's been a long, discordant legal battle. But the latest news sounds like a pure major key resolution.
It certainly does. The headline from Crunchbase News reads, Ripple lands 500 mil at 40B valuation as crypto's good year continues. That is a massive number, George. A 40 billion valuation puts it in a very exclusive club.
$40 billion. That's not just a funding announcement. That's a big, brassy fanfare. That's the entire horn section standing up and blasting a statement to the entire market. So for listeners who might only know Ripple from its long-running drama with the SEC, let's set the stage. What is the Ripple of today?
Right. It's important to look beyond the headlines of the past. Ripple was founded way back in 2012, making it a veteran in the crypto space. It was co-founded by Chris Larsen and Jed McKellib, though the current face of the company is definitely its CEO, Brad Garlinghouse. Their original mission, and still a core part of it, was to use blockchain technology and their digital asset, XRP, to make cross-border payments faster and cheaper than the traditional systems like SWIFT.
A classic disruption play, using new technology to improve an old, creaky system.
Exactly. But as Garlinghouse points out in their announcement, they've expanded dramatically. He says, we started in 2012 with one use case, payments, and have expanded that success into custody, stablecoins, prime brokerage, and corporate treasury. So they're no longer just a payments company.
They are building a full end-to-end financial services stack for institutions that want to engage with crypto and blockchain. They want to be the one-stop shop for any bank, hedge fund, or large corporation looking to get into the digital asset space.
So they're composing a much longer, more complex piece of music now. It started as a simple tune about payments, but it's evolved into a full-blown suite with multiple movements. Custody, brokerage, treasury, that kind of evolution over a decade is fascinating to watch. It takes real discipline and a long-term vision.
It does. And that vision just got a $500 million vote of confidence. This round was led by some incredibly serious names from both the crypto and traditional finance worlds. We're talking about funds managed by affiliates of Fortress Investment Group and Citadel Securities, alongside crypto natives like Pantera Capital, Galaxy Digital, and Brevan Howard.
Whoa, hang on. Citadel Securities? Fortress? These aren't just crypto-focused VCs who live and breathe this stuff. These are Wall Street behemoths. Having them lead a round is like getting a standing ovation at Carnegie Hall. It's a different level of validation. It tells you that the smart money in the traditional world believes that Ripple has built something durable and essential for the future of finance.
Absolutely. And it brings their total funding to just under $800 million since 2012, which is actually surprisingly lean when you consider they're now valued at $40 billion. But there's a slightly curious note in the story. The article mentions that this new funding follows a recent attempt at a $1 billion tender offer at the same valuation.
A tender offer, meaning they were trying to buy back shares from existing employees and early investors.
Correct, but the report claims that Ripple came up empty-handed on that offer. Now, the company hasn't commented extensively on it, but it does raise an interesting question. If the company is valued at $40 billion and you offer to buy back shares at that price, you'd expect a lot of people to take the opportunity for a massive payday. The fact that they reportedly didn't get many takers is interesting.
Interesting is a polite word for it. It's a bit of a mystery chord in the middle of a beautiful melody. On one hand, you could interpret it as the ultimate sign of confidence. Employees and early investors believe the company is worth so much more than $40 billion that they're not willing to sell. They're holding on for the crescendo of a future IPO or an even higher valuation.
That's the optimistic take, for sure. The "we're all true believers here" narrative.
The other interpretation is a bit more dissonant. Maybe the terms of the offer weren't quite right, or maybe there's some internal disagreement on valuation and control. It's hard to say from the outside, but it's a wrinkle in an otherwise pristine announcement. It's that one note that makes you tilt your head and go, what was that?
I lean towards the former, especially given the context of the broader market and Ripple's own recent history. The biggest thing to happen to them, and arguably the entire U.S. crypto industry in the last few years, was the SEC dropping its legal case against them in March. That lawsuit, which accused them of conducting an illegal securities offering with XRP, had been hanging over their head like a storm cloud since 2020.
Oh, it was more than a storm cloud. It was a fog that made it impossible to see the path forward. The legal uncertainty was a huge barrier to institutional adoption in the U.S. Getting that case dropped isn't just a win. It's like a complex, multi-year chord progression that has finally beautifully resolved. You can almost hear the collective sigh of relief from their entire ecosystem. It allows the music to flow freely again.
And that resolution has coincided with a fantastic year for crypto in the public markets. The article points to blockchain lender Figure having a strong debut, and more spectacularly, stablecoin issuer Circle closing up 168% on its first day of trading. There's a real appetite for credible, scaled crypto companies, and Ripple is arguably one of the most scaled of them all.
So the timing of this fundraise is impeccable. They've shared their biggest legal burden right as the market is getting hungry for what they're selling. That's not luck. That's smart navigation.
And they've been using their capital very aggressively to build out that institutional stack we talked about. The article notes they've made 6 acquisitions in just over 2 years, with 2 of them valued at over $1 billion each.
The most recent one was buying brokerage house Hidden Road for a staggering $1.25 billion.
That's a fascinating strategy. Instead of trying to build every instrument in the orchestra from scratch, they're acting like a master band leader, going out and recruiting the best soloists in the world to join their ensemble. You need a world-class prime brokerage? You go acquire one. You need custody? You buy a specialist. It's a way to accelerate your roadmap and instantly add new capabilities and, crucially, new talent.
It is, but it also comes with immense risk. Integrating one company is hard enough. Integrating six, including $2 billion-plus behemoths, in such a short period of time is a monumental task. You have to merge cultures, technology stacks, leadership teams. It's a huge challenge.
That's the conductor's main job, isn't it? Making sure the trumpets aren't drowning out the violins and that everyone is playing from the same sheet music. If they pull it off, they'll have an institutional powerhouse. If they don't, it can become a cacophony.
So let's break it down then. When you look at the opportunities for Ripple, they're immense. They are perfectly positioned as the trusted, regulated, institutional-grade bridge to the world of digital assets. They have the brand recognition, a huge war chest of capital, and now a much clearer regulatory path in the U.S. The market tailwinds are at their back.
I agree. The opportunity is to become the fundamental rhythm section for institutional crypto. They want to be the bass and drums that everything else is built on top of. The custody, the liquidity, the payments. It's a foundational play. And if they become that essential layer, the $40 billion valuation could look conservative in a few years.
But the risks are just as significant. First, as we mentioned, there's massive integration risk from all these acquisitions. Second, the crypto market itself is notoriously volatile. We're in a good year now, but a prolonged crypto winter could seriously dampen institutional appetite and slow their growth. Third, while the SEC case is behind them, regulatory risk in crypto is a permanent fixture. A different regulator or a different country could always present a new challenge.
And I'd add a fourth risk, the valuation itself. When you raise money at $40 billion, you've set the bar incredibly high. The pressure to perform, to grow into and beyond that number for an eventual IPO is immense. Every single quarter will be scrutinized. They have to keep the tempo up, and it's a very, very fast tempo.
It is, but for now, they are celebrating a massive fundraise and a landmark valuation. Ripple has weathered the storm and come out stronger, and they have the capital and the product suite to make a serious run at defining the future of institutional finance. It's an incredible story.
From a long, bluesy courtroom drama to a triumphant jazz festival headliner, it's quite the turnaround.
All right, from the digital, decentralized world of crypto, we're going to pivot to something incredibly tangible, something most of us do every single day without a second thought, and one company thinks they can completely reinvent it. We're talking about parking your car.
Parking, the universal experience of circling a block, finding a spot, and then fumbling for a credit card at a greasy, confusing payment kiosk. If someone has a better way, I am all ears. This sounds like a problem begging for a smoother rhythm.
Well, George, a company called Metropolis thinks they have the answer, and they've just raised an astonishing amount of capital to prove it. The headline is, AI-powered parking platform, Metropolis raises $500 million Series D at $5 billion.
Another $500 million round. It seems to be the magic number today, but this one feels different. This isn't about abstract digital assets. This is about concrete asphalt and the cars we drive on them. What's the magic here?
The magic is what they call checkout free parking. Metropolis was founded in 2017 and is based in LA, a city that knows a thing or two about parking headaches. What their CEO and co-founder is Alex Israel. What they've developed is a system that uses computer vision, cameras installed at the entrance and exit of parking garages and lots, to identify your car by its license plate.
So no ticket, no pulling a little paper stub?
None of that. The first time you use a Metropolis location, you sign up in their app with your name, license plate, and payment method.
After that, you just drive in and drive out of any facility in their network. The cameras see your car enter, they see it leave, they calculate how long you were there, and they automatically charge your card and email you a receipt. It's completely frictionless.
Now that is a thing of beauty. That's like a perfectly rehearsed rhythm section, so tight and in the pocket, you don't even notice it's there. The best rhythm is the one you feel, not the one you have to think about. This is the bass and drums of parking. It's just smooth.
That's exactly the goal. But the funding news is even more complex and impressive than just the Series D. The announcement was actually for a total of $1.6 billion in new capital. That breaks down into the $500 million Series D equity round, which valued them at $5 billion, and a massive $1.1 billion term loan from, wait for it, J.P. Morgan Chase Bank.
A billion-dollar loan from J.P. Morgan for a parking startup? My goodness, that's not just validation, that's the ultimate seal of approval from the establishment. Getting a nine-figure equity round from VCs like SoftBank, which they also have, is one thing. Getting a 10-figure debt facility from a bank like JPM means your business model is spitting out predictable, reliable cash flow that they can underwrite against. That is serious business.
It is, and it shows the sheer scale they've already achieved. According to the company, they process more than $5 billion in annual transaction volume across over 4,200 locations. They claim to have nearly 20 million members and are adding over a million new members per month. The growth is just staggering.
And their ambition goes way beyond just parking. The CEO, Alex Israel, talks about leading something called the recognition economy. That sounds like a big, bold, experimental concept. It sounds like he's trying to compose some free jazz here, pushing the boundaries of what's possible.
It does have that slightly jargony, tech utopian feel, but the idea behind it is powerful. He describes it as a new age of personalized intelligence, where presence replaces devices and credentials as the foundation for a more intuitive, connected, and human world.
Okay, break that down for me. What does presence replacing devices actually mean in practice?
It means that instead of you having to pull out your phone or your wallet to prove who you are and pay for something, the environment around you simply recognizes you and handles the transaction seamlessly in the background. Parking is just the first application. The release says they plan to expand into retail, hospitality, and fueling. Imagine pulling up to a gas pump, filling your tank, and just driving away. Or walking into a convenience store, grabbing a coffee, and just walking out. The system recognizes you and your car and just charges you.
So the world becomes an Amazon Go store. That's both incredibly convenient and slightly terrifying. It's a bold vision, and I can see why it would attract this level of investment. They're not selling parking software. They're selling a platform for frictionless physical commerce.
And to build that platform, they have made some gigantic strategic moves. Just like Ripple, their story is one of aggressive acquisition. Earlier this year, they bought an AI-powered biometrics startup called Usto for $125 million.
So they're adding facial recognition to the license plate recognition, layering the instruments.
Potentially, yes. But the real earth-shattering move was their acquisition in 2024. They took a publicly traded logistics and parking management firm called SP Plus private in a deal worth approximately $1.5 billion.
$1.5 billion for a parking logistics company? That seems like a tech company buying a very old school non-tech business.
It is, and it's the key to their whole strategy. SP Plus wasn't a tech company, but it was one of the largest operators of parking facilities and transportation services in North America. They had the contracts, the real estate relationships, and the on-the-ground operational staff. The acquisition instantly transformed Metropolis. The article notes they went from a 2,000-person company to one with more than 23,000 employees overnight.
Wow, that's not just adding a new soloist to your jazz combo. That's bolting on an entire 80-piece symphony mid-performance. The scale, the power, the sound becomes immense. But the complexity of conducting that many musicians, of getting them all to play in tune and on time,
It's a monumental challenge.
It's the ultimate hardware meets software play. Metropolis has the AI and computer vision tech, the software. SP Plus had the thousands of locations and employees, the hardware. By merging them, they can now deploy their technology across a massive pre-existing physical footprint. It gives them an incredible moat. It would be almost impossible for a new startup to replicate that physical network from scratch.
So when we look at the opportunities here, it's just massive. They are solving a real universal annoyance. The recognition economy, if they can pull it off, creates a platform with network effects that could extend into dozens of verticals. And the acquisition of SP Plus gives them an instant defensible scale that's hard to overstate. They have the tech, the physical footprint, and now the capital to wire it all together.
The opportunity is to become the invisible payment layer for a huge chunk of the physical world. It's a multi-trillion dollar addressable market when you think beyond just parking. If they become the Stripe for the physical world, then a $5 billion valuation is just the beginning.
A beautiful turn of phrase. I love that. But with an ambition that grand, the risks have to be equally colossal. My mind immediately goes to the operational complexity we just talked about. Managing 23,000 employees, most of whom came from a legacy, non-tech company, and trying to instill a new tech-forward culture is a Herculean task.
That's number one on my list, too. Integration risk is huge. Number two is the privacy aspect. The recognition economy sounds great until people realize it means their movements are being tracked and logged by a private company everywhere they go. A consumer or regulatory backlash over privacy is a very real and potentially existential threat. They will need to be incredibly transparent and responsible with that data.
Absolutely. The music can't be so smooth that people feel like they're being hypnotized. There has to be trust. What else?
The debt. That $1.1 billion loan from JP Morgan is a powerful tool, but it's also a heavy burden. They have to service that debt, which means the pressure to maintain and grow their cash flow is immense. A downturn in the economy, where people drive and spend less, could put serious pressure on their ability to meet those obligations. And finally, there's simple execution risk. Their vision is so grand that the chances of a misstep are high. Expanding from parking into retail or fueling involves completely different operational challenges and competitive landscapes.
It's true. They have to prove they can not only conduct the orchestra they just acquired, but also teach it to play a completely new, experimental type of music. It's a high-wire act. But wow, what an incredible, ambitious company. It's one of those ideas that's so simple on the surface, make parking easy, but so profoundly complex and powerful underneath.
It really is. And that brings us to the end of our company deep dives for today. What a fascinating pair to close on, George. Ripple, valued at $40 billion, trying to rewire the digital infrastructure of global finance. And Metropolis, valued at $5 billion, trying to rewire the physical infrastructure of our cities.
It's a perfect illustration of the moment we're in. Both companies are leveraging technology, blockchain for one, AI and computer vision for the other, to tackle enormous entrenched industries. But they're playing in completely different keys. Ripple is all about bits and bytes, global ledgers, and institutional trust. It's a cerebral, complex composition.
While Metropolis is about steel, concrete, and the daily, tangible frustrations of modern life, it's much more visceral.
Exactly. And yet, the themes are the same. We saw massive, late-stage funding rounds confirming unicorn and decacorn status. We saw how aggressive M&A is being used as a primary tool for hypergrowth and market consolidation. And we saw the power of a grand, ambitious vision to attract not just venture capital, but serious validation from the titans of traditional finance, like Citadel and JP Morgan.
I think my biggest takeaway from the whole episode is just the sheer scale of the capital and ambition at play. Whether it's building a new power grid from the ground up, defining the post-ChatGPT playbook, or raising $1 billion to fix parking, the stakes are higher than ever.
The capital markets are still providing a powerful rhythm, and these companies are using it to improvise and compose some truly spectacular music. It's an exciting and frankly astounding time to be watching the startup world.
It certainly is. And that's all the time we have for this episode of Startup Jazz. We hope you enjoyed the conversation as much as we did.
A huge thank you to you, our listeners, for tuning in and spending part of your day with us. We love digging into these stories, and we couldn't do it without you. A special thanks as well to our producer, David, and the whole team behind the scenes who make this show sound so smooth.
You can find links to the articles we discussed today in our show notes, and you can find us on all the major podcast platforms. If you enjoyed the show, please consider leaving us a review. It really helps other people discover Startup Jazz.
We'll be back soon with another episode diving into more of the most interesting fundings, acquisitions, and trends in the startup ecosystem. Until then, keep listening, keep innovating, and stay jazzy.
Horns blare loud, VCs banging down the door. Check stack high, we hit that billion mark for sure. Unicorn glow, they cheer the next big thing. But I'm stuck staring at the ghost this fame don't bring. Remember that garage, the nights we ate cold fries. Rejection letters, pile tears mixed with the lies. Toonish, too risky, words that cut like glass. Now they're kissing up, but where were they when we had no gas? Bebop beats wild, but my mind's in a spin. Acquisition offer burns or keep on chasing the wind. Uncertainty looms beyond this glittered haze. Built it from the dirt, now who gets to turn the page? Champagne pops, headline screams success so loud. But I taste the grit of every no that broke the crowd. VC's hound,
stroke faster.
Pressure's like a wave. Do I hold the wheel or sell the stream I fought to create? Horns wail bright, but the future's out of sight. Unicorn crown, it's heavy, not light. Hardships fade in the glow, but they're etched in my bones. Keep building cash out, my heart stuck in the zone. Unicorn bebop, fast, fierce, a little frayed. Glory sweet, but the fine's the part that never fades. Decision hangs sharp as a trumpet's blast. To keep the dream alive, or let it take flight.